By listening to the Conscious Fertility Podcast, you agree to not use this podcast as medical advice to treat any medical condition in either yourself or others. Consult your own physician or healthcare provider for any medical issues that you may be having. This entire disclaimer also applies to any guests or contributors to the podcast. Welcome to Conscious Fertility, the show that listens to all of your fertility questions so that you can move from fear and suffering to peace of mind and joy. My name is Lauren Brown. I'm a doctor of traditional Chinese medicine and a clinical hypnotherapist. I'm on a mission to explore all the paths to peak fertility and joyful living. It's time to learn how to be and receive so that you can create life on purpose. All right, we're about to enjoy an interview with Dr. Lawrence Pilewski, a holistic pediatrician. And I want to let you know that we recorded almost 2 hours, so we broke it into two parts, part one and part two. Part two is going to be on vaccinations, and part one is going to be on conscious parenting and raising healthy children. Just want to let you know, if you're listening to part one, there is a part two to this, just to break it up to make it easier for you to tune into. Today, I have Dr. Lawrence Pilewski on the Conscious Fertility Podcast, and he is a board-certified pediatrician specializing in holistic and integrative medicine. And many of you may be wondering, why am I having a pediatrician on the Conscious Fertility Podcast? Well, I like to think about the end in mind. And if you're looking to get pregnant as part of your journey, we want to know about how you're going to raise this child and have a healthy child, and maybe what you need to do to have that healthy child. But that's not the only reason why I'm having Dr. Larry Pilewski on our podcast today. Got to check out his background. He's trained at NYU School of Medicine. He has over 3 decades of experience, including work in pediatric emergency and intensive care. Dr. Pilewski takes a whole body approach to health. One of the reasons why we have him on our podcast. He addresses the physical, emotional, and spiritual well-being of children and families. He's known for his deep insights on childhood development, conscious parenting, and the root cause of illness. A sought-after speaker, educator, and advocate for critical thinking in medicine, Dr. Larry empowers parents to take charge of the family's health through informed choices and holistic care. Dr. Larry, welcome to the Conscious Fertility Podcast.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I've had an enjoyable time learning about you in preparing for our interview. And we've talked a little bit about off camera, but this idea of the Conscious Fertility Podcast, it's really about helping us heal ourselves, which also heals the planet. So the external world is like a reflection of our inner world. And so much of this is about doing our own inner work. And when I thought of this podcast idea way back in the day, it was we go from conscious fertility to conscious conception to conscious pregnancy to conscious parenting. And a lot of us get focused on where we are in the journey and not always realizing why we're doing what we're doing. Because I think so many people in this journey and they're struggling, but the real beginning is the birth of their child when they become this parent. And I wanted to talk to somebody who can address the health of the child, the spiritual health of the child, because really this is what we're here to do, or what the purpose of this podcast is to help the parents to be, to heal, so they can attach to their children and these children can grow up feeling whole and complete. So they don't need to do, they don't need to join gangs or do drugs. They feel whole and complete. And this is why I want to have you on the podcast. So hopefully that's not a lot of pressure on you.
No, not at all. Although there's something that you said that just struck a chord in me in what I do in my practice every day. Parents often forget about themselves when they become parents and they load everything onto the child. And then they bring the child to me and say, fix my child. And there's this, I don't know if it's a misunderstanding or just a not understanding, that kids don't learn by what you tell them. That's why one of the biggest complaints parents have is, my child won't listen to a word I say. Well, but they're not supposed to, because they're watching you, they're listening to you, and they're learning by modeling you. So if you're being a certain way, that's what they're going to copy. And so if you want them to learn something, if you want them to be a certain way, be that way. And so that gets into the conflict sometimes in the office, because the parent is wanting me to focus on the kid. I can't focus on the kid because the kid is not separate from who he is in his environment. and who he's living with in his environment. And so it's a delicate dance, Lauren, to actually raise the consciousness of the parent. And I'll give you one example before I end this piece. A number of years ago, I was working with a mom who had a 7-year-old boy who was diagnosed with ADHD. And I showed the mother how the brain develops and what parts of the brain get held up when a child is in the midst of a diagnosis of ADHD. He's impulsive, he's reactive, can't sit still, he's fidgety, calls out in class, not paying attention, distracted. And I went through all of the ways in which brain development happens and what are the factors that halt or interfere with optimal brain development so that he wouldn't be impulsive and he wouldn't be reactive and he would be able to focus. She sat there and she looked at me and she said, "How am I supposed to ask my child to stop being impulsive and reactive if I'm being impulsive and reactive in the house?" And I sat back and I looked at her and I said, "I think my work is done."
Yeah.
Because you got it. And when I work with a parent like that, I see exponential changes. I see lights go off and I see growth. And I think many times, Lauren, parents forget that they're not the only ones growing up when they're raising a child, that they have to go through their individual changes and shift and become more conscious about who their child is at 2 months, which is different than 5 months, which is different than 5 years. And you have to be a different person because you're in a relationship with a different kid.
And I like how you share this, because as we talked at the very beginning, the external world, I said, is a reflection of your inner world. And you just said the children is modeling you and they don't listen to you. They model you. And so I think of, like, it's almost like, if you ever heard of the work of Byron Katie, you know, she wrote the book Loving What Is. One of my teachers of conscious would always say this, like, if you walked in and said, "My child isn't listening to me," you go, "Who? My child isn't listening to me. Who? My child." And eventually, like, "Oh, I'm not listening to my child," right? Or, "I'm not listening to me," right? And so we can look at this at so many levels. And what I hope to accomplish today for our listeners and myself is, there's many that are listening that have children and they're looking to have more children. There are many listening that don't have children but want to know what they can do for their children. And everybody who's listening was once a child. And like you said, we still have to grow up ourselves so we can be these conscious parents. Before we talk more on conscious parenting, I really am curious, though, about you. How do you go from mainstream pediatrician in the emergency and intensive care to being shift toward what you're calling integrative mind, body, spirit approach? So what's your story?
I was always a very inquisitive kid. And I asked more questions in school and at home than was tolerated. And I would hear things and my mind would just work so fast that I would be 2, 3, 4 steps ahead of what was being taught, because each thing that was taught would trigger like 5 or 6 tributaries of more thinking. And I didn't know what that was. I didn't know that it was told to me later on as a gift. I just knew that my mind worked that way. And so when I got to medical school, I felt like there was a vice over my head, because so much of that, you know, tributary thinking had to be, you know, stifled, even though I tried to find ways. But once I got out into the world after training, I would see things in life that didn't fit what I was taught in medical school and residency. And rather than just brush it under the table, I just kept asking questions. And I got more and more curious when I couldn't find the answers. And so I'm an answer seeker. I am a truth seeker. And so if I don't know the answer, I want to find out the answer. And if I don't understand something, I want to find out how to understand it. And I was never somebody, and this is, you know, it has its pluses and minuses, but I was never somebody who trusted authority. So if you told me something, I was going to question it. And I was never someone who just took what you said and said, "Oh yeah, I don't have to think. I'll just believe what you said." I had to explore it myself. And so it just kept growing, Lauren, because once I opened one door of curiosity, there were 10. And then I opened those 10 and there were 100. And it just kept exponentially increasing, such that I never stop asking questions. And it comes from the ability to be curious. And I often say to new parents, you know, you're accomplished people. You've gotten to this place in your life because you've succeeded on many different levels. And now you're the parents of newborn and you have no idea what you're doing. And so how much fun you have will be determined by how well you can deal with uncertainty, unknown, and curiosity.
Love it.
And that's how I try to live. Just keep it in that framework.
And because of your critical thinking, I hope we get to, I know you've spoken a lot on vaccinations, and that's also a hot topic. So I want to hear more about your opinion and your philosophy around that. Before we go into that, I kind of want to go into this conscious parenting idea. And parents, you know, it's like programmed. They love this child, right? And they want to protect it. And I've been guilty of this too at times where, you know, I want to protect my child. Like, I don't want them to have any negative emotions. They can't feel any pain or suffering. Like, I remember when my kid was really young, jumping on the couch and he landed and cut his eye, this corner of his eye open. It's so sad because he was no longer perfect. He had a scar, right? But I heard you say, and I want you to kind of go into your metaphor, because I really liked it about parents, their role is guardrails. And to tie that into how you see conscious parenting, and are we actually helping our children when we're protecting them? Like when we're putting bubble wrap around them, or maybe trying to put bubble wrap around the world so our kid feels no emotional or physical pain. Right.
I totally understand that, because I watch the battle. It's sort of a dance and a tug of war that every parent goes through, because every parent has to lie to their baby as soon as the baby is born. And what's that lie? I will always be there for you. I will never abandon you. I will be everything you'll ever need. I will take care of everything you'll ever need. You will not want for anything. And I will be your everything. And then as the baby grows, the parent has to undo that lie, because you cannot be everything for your child. And the more you try to be the everything for your child, the more conflict you will have in raising that child. And so I'll look at parents and I'll say, do you want your child to think for him or herself? Yes. So then how will your child learn to do that if you're answering everything for them? Do you want your child to learn how to problem solve? Yes. How will your child learn to problem solve if you step in and problem solve for them? Do you want your child to learn how to deal with discomfort in life? Well, yes. How will your child learn to deal with discomfort if you take it away from them as soon as it starts? And so the guardrail metaphor is, your child is on his or her road, and you're the guardrail. You help to guide the curvature of that road. But ultimately, if you're getting on the road, there's going to be conflict. Because if you want your child to be self-sufficient, and you want your child to be confident, and you want your child to feel worthy, you can't fix their problems, correct their mistakes, answer their questions, or solve their inquiries. And that's a dance that we have to do. And I never answer a kid's question. Like, a kid will look at me and say, Dr. Larry, what's this? I don't know. What do you think it is? And most of the time, what I find out, Lauren, is that when a kid asks me a question, they're not looking for the answer. They're looking for my heart. They're looking for connection from me. They want to have some kind of heart-to-heart relationship. Because most of the time when I say to them, I don't know, what do you think? Most of the time they give me the answer. And so that's a dance that we have to do, because we have to teach kids that comfort exists, but it doesn't last. We have to teach kids that discomfort exists and it doesn't last. And if we take away the discomfort from them to see that there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, and that they survive and thrive, having gotten through it in your presence, in your connection, then if you don't allow that to happen, how are they going to know that when you're not there, they have the foundation, they have the fortitude, they have the will, the skills to say, oh, all right, I know how to deal with this. I won't die. I'm okay. But if you come in and distract them and dance for them and, oh, look at over here, and oh, try this or eat this, you end up stunting their growth and you end up taking care of your ego and your satisfaction rather than showing them that you can stay present with them and demonstrate in their presence that with their discomfort and your presence, it resolves. And that builds fortitude. That gives them the sense that I can make it. I will die if I'm uncomfortable. And that's a dance that I'm teaching all the time. And it's a dance that I'm doing all the time because I wouldn't be teaching it if it weren't something that I had to do for myself.
Right. We often track what we need to learn, right? And you said something, though, that I kind of want to unpack a bit more that excited me as well as you were talking about being present with them. And so that child can lean into you and feel their emotions. And so I need a moment to unpack this because in my practice where I do conscious work, a big part of it is to teach us as adults how to be present with our emotions. So rather than resisting them, Tara Bach would say, another teacher of Buddhism or consciousness, you know, your issues are stuck in your tissues. I get the sense from many authors I've read that children are kind of present. And so they have an experience. So it's frustration or sadness. They find their tears of futility. And if they can experience it and release it in 90 seconds, it's gone and they're back to that state of peace. But we get it stuck in their tissue because we don't want them to feel sad. We're almost showing them it's not right to be sad and we try to fix it versus them experience it. And we've seen this, a child's upset and then they're happy again in a second, right?
Right.
Can you talk on this a bit from what you were already sharing?
Sure. Well, one of the things that I teach parents is children are supposed to do what they're not supposed to do. Because kids are supposed to learn by doing. And if you take the guardrail and the road analogy again, kids are supposed to jump over the guardrail. It's our jobs to pick them up and put them back on their road. And they're looking for us to be the guide, not the reactor, not jumping over. Oh my God, this is terrible. What did we do? Oh my, you know, they're looking for us to contain ourselves in an environment of a little bit of hysteria that they portray. And the language I often use is I ask parents to South Pole their kids. And they look at me like, what does that mean?
I'm giving you the same look.
Yeah. So if a child is behaving in hysterics or in lots of energy and irritable and a little out of sorts, I call that the North Pole of a magnet. Now, you bring another North Pole of the magnet with the same behavior, you're going to repel, right? So if you get hysterical, if they're upset and you're like, oh my God, I can't let you be upset, well, then you're being another North Pole of a magnet. And when you come together, it repels. And children require us to be the South Pole. They require us to deal with our own crap in the moment, so that they can feel free to express their crap safe enough so they can move through it. They can have the beginning, the middle, and the end, and we're there present to hold the space as a container. And so that's what I mean by South Pole your kid. Be the presence after you've surveyed the field and seen that this is not an emergency, that there's no reason to call 911, that there's no reason to get hysterical, and just bear with them as they move through their expressions, because they need to be in a place that's safe enough for them to do the things that they're not supposed to do.
A follow-up on this. One is, I'm curious if you've seen this in practice and if you have an explanation for this. I'm going to give you my understanding. I often see parents that come in and they have their children having issues. And what I subscribe to is when you, the parent, heals, your whole family constellation heals. Your spouse benefits, your children benefits, and maybe even your ancestors benefit. The parents do the work, has nothing to do with the child. They're going in doing their work. They're doing their inner child work. And all of a sudden, their children's behavior changes. Do you have an explanation? Have you seen this as well? That so So the child doesn't have to go do the work. It's the parent, right? It's like my mother-in-law, who's a child psychologist. When parents come in, she actually is very aware she's treating the parent's dysfunction, not the child. So I'd love to hear your take on this.
Well, again, the child is less capable of being South Pole than the parent. And so it's the parent's work to provide the calm so that the child can lean into it and feel comfortable. And I think sometimes we forget that you're in relationship, which means it's two ways. It's not just a one-way street. I'm the parent, you're the child, and everything is this way. No, the child learns how to be, a boy learns how to be a man by watching his father. A girl learns how to be a girl by watching her mother. A girl learns how to treat men by watching the way the mother treats the father. A boy learns how to treat women by watching how the father treats the mother. There's all of this dynamic that the children are watching. And if we don't realize that children are responding to us and we are responding to them, that it's a two-way street. It's not just I sit on high and you just kowtow to everything I say and do, and I'm not involved in this relationship. I think we have a lot more to talk about. But children are learning who they are. They often say that when a baby is born, he or she learns who she is through the eyes of the mother. And so it's a relationship. And a very simple example of that is if a baby in my office is crying, I hear the parents say, "It's okay, it's okay, it's okay." And guess what? The kid doesn't get better. The kid doesn't stop crying. And I look at the child and I say, "I know, sweetheart, you're really upset. I understand you." The kid stops crying. And the parent tries to like figure out what I did. And I look at the parent and I say, "Well, how would you like it if you're upset and you're crying and someone puts their hand on your shoulder and says, 'It's okay, it's okay.'" And the parent says, "Well, I'd be really upset." I said, "So what do you think you're doing in the relationship with your child by dismissing how she's feeling?" I said, "All I did was connect to her heart and say, 'I know, sweetie, I know you're upset. I'm right here with you.'" Because you gave the child an opportunity to be seen, to be heard, to be recognized.
That's
acknowledged.
That's the key. Gordon Neufeld, who's a local attachment therapist, psychologist here, in one of his courses, that was my big aha moment. He used his line is, every human being wants the same thing, to be seen and heard, which equals feeling loved. Mm-hmm. And so if you tell the kid, "Don't cry, you don't need to cry," you dismiss them. They don't feel seen and heard. And when you see and hear somebody, you're not saying you agree with them. You're just saying, "I get how you feel. I can see why you think and feel that way." Right. And that automatic lowers the resistance. It brings in the safety. And so just being able to see and hear them is key.
Lord, I've seen 3-month-olds, 5-month-olds, 6-month-olds. When I say to them, "I know, sweetie, you're so upset. Here, let me hold you. I'll hold you. I know." Yeah. They stop. And I use the expression, I knew. To try to teach parents. I acknowledge you, and then I parent you. "Sweetie, I understand you want that right now. I'm not able to give it to you. I know you want to eat that food. I'm not giving it to you right now." I you. You acknowledge, and then you parent. Because everyone that comes into my office, including me, I look at them and I say, "I know no one was raised. I understand. I'm not going to allow you to go to that event. We were told, you're not going. That's it. Final. Go to your room." No one was brought up in relationship. Mm-hmm. It was mostly brought up in tyranny. And I use those in extremes because there's a sine curve in between that. But when you acknowledge somebody for how they feel, you automatically take the heart flutter and bring it to here. And I'll never forget, I had a mother came to me for a prenatal visit, and she said to me, "Dr. Larry, I can't stop eating the muffins at the supermarket. I'm just eating them and eating them and eating them." And, you know, if you're practicing healthy eating and, you know, proper nutrition during pregnancy, you'd say, you know, that's not good for you. You know, you really need to not do that. But I didn't do that. I looked at her and I said, "Wow, you really need a lot of soothing, don't you?" And she just went like this. I just noticed her. And then I said, "You think maybe you can eat the muffins from Whole Foods instead?" Because she was eating the regular grocery muffins.
Yeah.
She laughed. She chuckled. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to just tell the listeners, this is a practice. I'm not proficient at this all the time, but I'm in practice doing this. And it's the idea of being able to hold the space that you can handle the emotions that you're dealing with and be able to be present for someone else while still being present for yourself.
That's the key. Because what you said, be the South Pole. So you got to, you know, hold the space. I always say the alpha parent, be there so they can lean into you. That requires your own practice, your own inner work. Because if the child is suffering and you have all these wounds inside of you, it's going to trigger you. So you can't stay present for the child. You said be present for them. I use the word be present or be resource, but you have to be able to see you and hear you first. You have to be able to be in practice so you can stay present. So it's not just good intentions, because that subconscious, Viktor Frankl says it perfectly, right? And this is how I've modified his quote. He's the author of The Man's Search for Meaning. He says, in every situation, you either habitually, unconsciously react, or you can consciously choose to respond. You being the South Pole, being the guardrails, is consciously choosing to respond. But because, as Neufeld says, we've all been raised by behaviorists, not developmentalists, the kid's freaking out. Maybe they did something and now we're embarrassed, and now our shame and guilt's triggered, and now that hijacks us, and now we're our parents. So you have to do a practice.
To dovetail that, if a child is uncomfortable and the parent wants it to go away, when I'm able to, I'll look at the parent and say, "Do you have trouble dealing with discomfort in yourself?" Because that's really the trigger for the parent to make it all go away so that the child doesn't feel bad. And I'll never forget, it was about 18 years ago, about 2006, 2007, where I was working with a child and a mother. The kid had ADHD, and I was trying to describe how to parent the kid differently. And the mother said to me on the phone, "But I don't want my child to feel bad." And I said, I see where the problem is now. And that's really the dance that I was talking about, Lauren, where we have to allow for a safe enough place for a child to experience 50% of the world so they can actually manifest the skill set to cope with what it means to feel bad, not get what you want, be upset, be sad, and realize they are developing the tools to get through it in such a way that there's no anxiety. They don't need to eat. They don't need to drink. They don't need to do drugs. They don't need to go out and have sex. They don't need to have party. They don't need an addiction or a habit that makes them feel better.
They get the attachment to the parents. I went and did the conscious parenting courses, and because I thought I wanted to be a developmental parent versus a behaviorist, so my kid could grow up whole and complete and be a contributor to society, as in a good for change, right? What I realized is I was at the beginning doing the conscious parenting so I could still control my kid's behavior. because I remember a year or two into it, I was like, this isn't working. They're like, what are you talking about? I explain all the behaviors my kid's doing. And I go, when they go to somebody else's house, because they were young, but still now having played it, they're angels. They do everything. And he goes, then you're doing it right. And I go, why? And he goes, they know you unconditionally love them. They feel safe. They feel safe to do all this other stuff in your home, but they don't feel safe in the other person's home. So they are learning, because in the other home, they're great behavior. But they said, you're doing wonderful. So I said, so you're telling me by being this conscious parent, I'm going to have these kids like this? He goes, yeah, they're going to test you. Is that Did I hit the nail there?
I can't tell you how many times a parent has come to me because the kid doesn't sit still, the kid is misbehaving, the child isn't listening, child's not cooperating, doesn't do the chores. And then I say, how does the child perform outside the house? Oh, he's fine. There's no problem at all. And then I look at the parent and I say, well, what do you think is going on if outside the house, the child is not exhibiting those behaviors? Because it's very, you know, when I first started this work, and I started it well 30 more years ago in practice, and I was young, you know, so when you're young, you have a little sharper edge, you know, you're a little more blunt, you're a little less careful about what you say. And so when I first started it, I came across as if I was blaming parents. And then I had to realize that if I wanted to gather parents to lean into me, I had to show them accountability and responsibility without blame. And that's not always easy because of who each parent is, their sensitivity, their shame button, their embarrassed button. You know, we all try to hide behind a certain, you know, veneer so that, you know, people don't see our vulnerabilities. And once I started doing my own inner work, where I started saying, oh my gosh, I'm vulnerable, or I started showing vulnerability in the office without going past a certain line, I realized that everything started to shift even more. Because when people see your vulnerability as a practitioner without really, you know, crossing the line, there's a safety that they can then go, oh, well, if, you know, maybe it's safe to be vulnerable here. And so I had to finesse how to allow for vulnerability because I was finessing how to be vulnerable. And it was just interesting dance. And of course, I'm still doing it because I'm alive and still in process. But it's really about having the ability to be vulnerable and reduce the shame and reduce the embarrassment and have a little sense of humor towards yourself. And again, a lot of that will happen as you heal the heart, as you open the heart, as you stay present, as you acknowledge yourself, acknowledge, well, how am I feeling here? Versus, oh, it's all you, it's all you, it's all you.
Right. You really start to, you know, like you said, you don't blame the other and you don't take yourself seriously, right? You really, it becomes playful when you really start to do the healing. You really start to laugh at yourself and then be vulnerable.
Well, you know, a couple of months ago, I was asked on a podcast if I could, it was a consciousness podcast, and I was asked if you could wave a magic wand, what would you want to see? And I said, I'd love to be able to see people develop the skills to see the world through other people's eyes, because that's what I think is really missing, is that compassion, that ability to understand how someone sitting in front of you or on the phone or across a screen may be experiencing life, and not just think that because you see it a certain way, it is that way. And that goes back to your question about, you know, kids and the parent, you know, the parent not believing that it's just a one-way street. The kid is trying to see things through your eyes. Are you trying to see things through the kid's eyes?
And when you talked about, you know, blaming others, that's where, you know, you have inner work. And I use that as a cue for myself that if I see something in somebody else that I do not like, then that means somewhere in me, I'm denying that aspect of me. I may not act on it, but I have a piece of me that's like that. And it's easier to hate it in the other than in myself. And then when I come and do this work and find compassion for it and come alongside it, and the compassion grows from coming alongside and accepting that part of myself, it's amazing that now when I see it in the other person, I have compassion for it, which lets me know now I have compassion and self-acceptance for self. So the external environment, again, just becomes a reflection for where I have opportunity for growth. Do you kind of subscribe to that?
Well, yeah. I mean, in my own personal work, I have come to understand that the people with whom I interact are really just mirrors for me.
There we go.
The idea that the parent isn't a mirror for the child is a significant problem, because you are that mirror. The child is reflecting off you and dancing off you. And the child not only has to have you in their heads, the children not only have to have you in their heads, but they have to figure out themselves in their heads.
Right.
And it's a dance that has to happen, which is why I don't answer kids' questions when they ask me, because I want them to figure it out. I want them to know who they are, not how I see it, so they can accept how I see it.
I have things written down that I hope we get to. I have a few things I want to ask. One is a tangent, actually, curiosity. I'm curious about your spiritual background. And I ask this because so many things that you're sharing, I feel we're aligned with. And so many of the spiritual teachers I've read or have taken workshops have met, when I dig and I learn some of their sources, so many of them have been inspired by the Course in Miracles. And I'm just curious if you're familiar with it, read it, or has that influenced you? Because, and there are people like Vernon Howard, who wrote a book, one of the first books I read on spirituality, The Mystic's Path to Cosmic Power. Sounds like a book on Course in Miracles, but it was published before Course in Miracles was. So maybe truth is just truth. but I'm curious if you've heard of that, and what is your big influence for how you're walking through life and the spiritual life that you seem to be living?
That's such an interesting question, Lauren. I have to be honest. I've not read any of those books that you're describing, and I've not listened to any of the audios of what you're describing. I seem to be on a different track, and it's just who I am and how I function. But I have had a couple of very core people with whom I've worked on my own traumas and my own difficulties and whatever anxieties and depressions I've had. And I've worked with them in sessions. I've also done my meditations, but I'm a seeker, and I ask the questions enough where I work on things and they come. And I have family members who are very, very Orthodox Jewish people, and many rabbis. And when I speak to one of my cousins who's a rabbi, he sometimes wonders how I know the things I know without having read the Torah or the scriptures.
Right.
What I say to him is, it's in the ethers to grasp. It's there to access for everyone. And for whatever reason, you know, I have not been taught by any one person. I've just been a self-taught person with some people around me who've been very influential. The best teachers in my life are not the ones who've given me answers, but the ones who provided the space for me to pursue the line of questioning and the line of digging that I've done to access the answers. And I have to say that I have used psychedelics as more of a recent in the last 5 years. I can't say that that's been the thing that's worked, but I'll say that it's helped along the way. And I just have been sort of aha-ing a lot with my own inquiry.
Thank you for that. And seeker, always been curious has been my, hence how do I go from a CPA to what I do now, right? Always been a seeker, always learning from many teachers. So we're seekers. And so now, because of your background, I'm going to ask questions. And now we're going to do a Talmudic approach.
Wow.
Because we're going to talk about ADHD and we're going to talk about vaccines. The ADHD personal experience, when I was in grade two, my teacher wanted to put me on Ritalin. And my mother said no, right? Because I was like one of my sons, which I allowed it, when he would eat, he'd grab a bite and then run around the kitchen, run around, and then sit, take a bite, run around. And it was through that conscious parenting course saying, let it be, right? Like, is he eating? Yeah, then let him eat. That's how he eats, right? So when I was older, I was in a course, and it was something that I was like, oh, I don't have to be shamed with my mind, my ADHD mind, because he said it was a crazy, awesome strategic coaching for entrepreneurs. And they had this kind of personality charting to do. And basically, if you're a quick start, most quick starts are entrepreneurs. And most quick starts are what medical doctors would call ADHD. And he says that your brain is a certain way, which is why you come up with all these ideas. You're the one that's going to be the visionary. You don't want to medicate that, because we need those people. Then we need other people that can organize and help manifest. And so I'd like to hear your medical doctor and your spiritual doctor perspective on this. And for our listeners, reminding you, this isn't medical advice. Even though Dr. Larry is a doctor, he's not your doctor.
So I think it was either in the late 80s or early 90s. I was born in 1961. So late 80s, early 90s, I read the book, The Indigo Children.
Okay, yeah.
And then I said, okay, I understand a little bit about myself now. And so I was probably one of the early ADHD kids who didn't get medicated, thankfully. But there is certainly a core group of people who are truly attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And then there's the intolerance in society for what could be construed as normal behavior in kids. And when I did a lecture actually in September of 2024 at a medical conference called MAPS, Medical Academy for Pediatric Special Needs. And the title, basically I talked about ADHD and how we sometimes misrepresent it and misdiagnose it, because sometimes kids who are diagnosed with ADHD have really bad food allergies and aren't sleeping well. And if you actually find out their allergies and get them to sleep through the night, during the day, they're calm. They don't have hyperactivity and distraction. And some children with ADHD are missed because they have poor vision, and they're not their eyesight, but their vision is off. So they need certain kinds of prism glasses to actually relax both eyes to work together so that they can actually feel calm when they're working and when they're doing things. Some kids with ADHD are misdiagnosed because they have an inflammatory toxic component in their brain that's not addressed. And then, of course, there's traumas and parasites and molds and, you know, nettles and all these things that are affecting the brain. So if you look at it from the 30,000 foot view, what is the front of the brain in the human brain? It's the part of the brain that helps you think, reason, analyze, concentrate, focus, pay attention, problem solve, understand, learn, have knowledge. But that part of the brain doesn't automatically develop those abilities at birth. You have to grow into it as your brain develops. And so that front of the brain, Lauren, is not well developed. It's not even developed when babies are born. In fact, it's mostly undeveloped. And so in order to get that part of the brain to develop, other things have to happen in other parts of the brain. And so when humans are born, we're born like any other mammal and any reptile. We live in a reptilian brain, and that's the hindbrain. And that's the brain of survival, the brain of emergency and danger, high alert. It's the brain of addiction. It's the brain of panic, anxiety, fear, adrenaline, emergency. I have to have it now or I'll die. It's the subconscious brain. It's the part of the brain that's activated when you have to run out of a burning building. And so that's the dominant part of the brain when we're born. But as we get older, that part of the brain is supposed to quiet as we move into the middle part of the brain and its development, and the front of the brain and its development. But the front of the brain can't develop if the back of the brain is still in fight or flight response, because it's two different blood flows. You can't sit and think and relax if your brain stem believes that it's in danger in an emergency. And so if you have inflammation, if you have trauma, if you have anxiety, panic, fear, if you have food sensitivities, poor vision, poor sleep, mold, toxins, parasites, emotional issues. It's going to consume the activation of your fight or flight response, which means you're not going to sit still because your brain is told that it's in danger. And when your brain is told that you're in danger, you got to move, right? And it's not conscious. It's impulsive. It's reactive. It's moving involuntarily. And when that part of the brain is hyper dominant, this front of the brain shuts off. You don't think while you're running out of a burning building. And so as a physician, my job is to understand why the front of the brain's blood supply and action and dominance has reduced and what is inflaming and hyperstimulating the brainstem to believe that it's in danger all the time, such that there's constant movement, because the movement is really a way for the brain to shake off the sense that something is damaging or dangerous. And when I work with kids like that or adults, and we identify what the factor is or the factors are that are keeping that hindbrain activity as if there's high adrenaline and inflammation, and we modify it, there's no ADHD, not at all. And some of those kids, Lauren, they just got to get out and ground themselves in the grass and be in nature and get the sun. And a lot of them get better. But we feed them better. We get them to sleep better. We fix their eyes and their vision problems. We get the molds down. We treat parasites if they're there. We get metals out. We talk to parents about parenting. And there's no ADHD. And then we work on the traumas, which set themselves in ways that bring about an ADHD diagnosis.
Thank you. That was such an excellent explanation. And to unpack that for myself and our listeners is, so you're seeing a kind of an inflammatory response going on in this child, and there's many contributing factors, some of them very physical, mold in the house, the diet, they have food sensitivity, so the diet they're being fed, environmental chemicals, and then you talked about some of the emotions, because emotions and stress can affect or cause inflammation and get you out of parasympathetic into that fight or flight, into the hindbrain. And then to tie this into what we talked about earlier, and where I called it, parents can act like Wi-Fi. I've heard someone say that children express what's between the parents and behind the parents, meaning that transgenerational trauma can get passed on to the child. So your child could be born because it's been imprinted on from two or three generations before. And we've seen this in research on Holocaust survivors. We've seen this in the cherry blossom study, where they show that trauma can get transferred into future generations.
What you're describing is something well documented in the literature called transgenerational epigenetics. Mm-hmm. So that does have its role in looking at deeper traumas. But I want to just raise the idea that electromagnetic radiation has become one of the greatest contributing factors to ADD and ADHD. I left that out because it's literally turning an electric circuit on in your body and keeping you on and buzzed. And certainly if you have metals in your brain, you're going to light up. And the idea is you can't use the front of the brain without parasympathetic dominant state. And if you're in a hypersympathetic state, you're going to turn this part of the brain off. And so medication doesn't change that physiology. All it does is mask your ability to express your physiology. And so the goal for me to create optimal wellness is to bring the child's body down from that hypersympathetic state. Because no one can survive in a hypersympathetic state, and it's only supposed to be used for emergencies.
Going back to the ADHD, when you say magnetic, you're talking about like just all the waves that are being sent. We got radio waves, TV waves, we got our phones and Wi-Fi, and who else?
So there's dirty electricity in the house. Mm-hmm. There's smart meters. There's holding the phones, holding the iPads, holding the laptops. It's having the cell phones by your bed, keeping it on your lap. It's being in a Wi-Fi environment. I do not have Wi-Fi in my house for 5 years. I won't have Wi-Fi in my house. It's getting rid of smart meters, trying not to live near cell towers. There's a large, large contributing factor in the chronic illnesses of our children and adults because of the constant buzzing of these waves.
How do people learn more about you? Like, what's the, because you have a lot of resources. We can list them all in the show notes for sure. And is there a place where they can go and then find your podcast, find your blogs, find any posts or research you've done? Where would you like us to direct people on social media and your website?
My website is drpalevsky, that's PalevSky.com. On there, you'll see my newsletters. Embedded in my newsletters, you'll see all the articles that I found interesting, some of the things I wrote, podcasts that I've done, interviews that I've done. There's also a video section on my website where people can get that. I have an Instagram account, dr.palevsky. I have a Telegram account, drpalevsky. I have Rumble, I have MeWe, I have Facebook. It's all on there. And I look forward to people coming and visiting and getting some information to empower you to learn more.
Thank you very much, Dr. Larry.
Thank you.
If you're looking for support to grow your family, contact AccuBalance Wellness Center. At AccuBalance, they help you reach your peak fertility potential through their integrative approach, using low-level laser therapy, fertility acupuncture, and naturopathic medicine. Download the AccuBalance Fertility Diet and Dr. Brown's video for mastering manifestation and clearing subconscious blocks. Go to AccuBalance.ca, that's ACUBalance.ca.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Conscious Fertility, the show that helps you receive life on purpose. Please take a moment to subscribe to the show and join the community of women and men on their path to peak fertility and choosing to live consciously on purpose. I would love to continue this conversation with you, so please direct message me on Instagram at Lauren Brown Official. That's Instagram, Lauren Brown Official. Or you can visit my websites, laurenbrown.com and accubalance.ca. Until the next episode, stay curious, and for a few moments, bring your awareness to your heart center and breathe.